Morning, friends. My name is Rick Robichaud, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm not a Mexican. Would you help me open this meeting with the serenity prayer, please?
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I've died and gone to alcoholic heaven. I know it. I've never seen anything like this in my entire life. Not anywhere have I been that's looked anything like this. I sure never thought I'd end up in a place like this. I didn't know any place like this existed. Even a Guelph convention can't deal with this. I brought my wife with me, my higher power. I don't go anywhere without her. Yeah, that's right. She won't let me. There they are already, eh? The hecklers. Right. I am from Kitchener, Waterloo, which is in Canada, about 60 miles from Toronto. I am 43 years old, and I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous since August the 15th, 1983. And I'm really grateful for that, I'll tell you. I haven't found anything like this on the face of the earth. And I'm a little scared this morning. I have a little bit of fear. Some people get butterflies. I don't. I get bats. You know, and I don't like doing this kind of thing, you know. I'm used to working behind the lines at the Guelph Convention with people. And I'm used to running around and entertaining people and getting them places to sleep and working with my wife. She's been on that convention for 5 years. And it's been a big part of our sobriety. And this is really different for me to be on this side of the coin, you know. I got one of my friends there that I see every year. She's here to laugh at me this morning. She promised me she'd be here. And this is really different. This is a treat in itself, I'll tell you. I've not experienced anything like this. Before I get into this earth-shattering revelation of a message of mine, we've been in town since Friday night, and Don's been whining and dining us, and I'll tell you, we have been everywhere. I can't believe the places that we've been to. I've heard some great leads since I've been here. And I've been praying since the day I've been sober that I would have an opportunity to come down here sometime, not necessarily to speak, but to get down to see Dr. Bill's house or Dr. Bob's house and those kind of things that I read so much about up in Canada, you know. They have a very special place in my heart, and we had that treat this weekend, and I can tell you, there's no words that can explain that for me. And if you haven't been to Dr. Bob's house and you live here, shame on you. I'm telling you, that is really, really a treat. We were down to the gravesite and down to the gatehouse, and when I walked into that place, I'm telling you, I got to hammer the goosebumps down with a hammer, you know. And somebody said, welcome home, and I was just crying on the inside for a couple of hours. I'll tell you, that is really, really a special, special blessing. That'll be with me for the rest of my life, you know. It really will. You should get down there if you haven't been there. That's really special. I've known Don for a couple of years, and this guy works his heart out down here. God, this man works hard, you know. He runs about 20 out of 24 hours a day. I don't know how he does it, you know, at his age, but he's a runner. And I want to thank Don for having us down. And my friend Mike up there and my other friend Mike, I heard him on Friday night. And Mike drugged me out to a meeting Saturday morning, and I heard him. And boy, I'll tell you, this is a great place to be. Oh, you guys got it all down here. You don't waste no time either. You know, up in Canada, we do a lot of stuff like we read and read and read and read. It's like being in a library sometimes. You never get to the meeting, and the poor speaker's down there dying of a heart attack, waiting to get up, and by the time he gets up there, he's got about 15 minutes, and he goes on and just rambles and falls, and people start getting up. It's just crazy, you know? Do you people know how to do it down here? I like that. I really do. I want you to know that before I share with you this morning, that I don't bring nothing unique here with me this morning. Everything I know, everything that I've learned since the day I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have learned here, and I've stolen from you people. You know, I was really, really crazy when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know anything about 12 steps or 12 traditions. I didn't know anything about, a lifestyle of living, because all I wanted to do when I got here was die. I'll ask you to keep an open mind this morning. It's only my story. And it's not unlike a lot of stories you'll hear around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's got all kinds of stuff in it that I don't like to talk about because I spent my whole life hiding from that stuff and hiding it from other people. Because it seemed like any time anybody found out who I was or what I was inside, they didn't want to be around me anymore, you know. And I'm willing to get up and take that chance today because I no longer have to live that way. Thank God and Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I'm really, really grateful for that. I come from a funny part of Canada. I come from Nova Scotia. And that's on the far east part of the country. It's about 500 miles from Newfoundland. I was brought up in a small town in Nova Scotia, and I was brought up by the railroad tracks, a rather rough part of town. And I was brought up in a fine family of drinkers, and I'm not here to take my mother and father's inventory this morning or anybody else's, but that's what I did for my whole life before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was always the victim. I was always the person that was hard done by and never loved and never taken care of. And it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I discovered a lot of stuff about myself, you know. The things that I remember most about my childhood is things that I felt were fear and anger. I was an angry child. I came from a poor family, and I lived in an alley by the train tracks, and everybody in that alley seemed to be drinking all the time and fighting. There was a lot of violence in the where I was brought up. There was a lot of large families. I come from a family of 8 children, and I'm the second oldest boy. I have 3 older sisters and 1 older brother, and I'm the only one of the family that, you know, that's blessed with this program. We came from a family of hard workers. My father worked hard all of his life. And he had to provide for the kids. He bought our home in the hungry 30s. And my mother had to work 7 days a week with 8 children. You really got to work hard to keep up with us. We were working when we were very young and going to school. And my father, I was brought up in a Catholic family. And I'm not sure there's any cure for that. You know, I got a few friends that are still recovering. I don't have anything against any any religions, by the way, today. I no longer feel the same way today as I did before I got Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was an angry person when I got here. And when I was told about God and religion as a child, it seemed like that stuff was always used to keep me walking a straight line. I was always told that if I did this, I was going to burn, and if I did this, that I would be okay, and there was a whole lot of other philosophies thrown in there that I was really confused with and that I didn't understand. I never felt good about myself since day one. I don't know what other people did, but I never felt good. I never felt like I fit any place. I always felt like a square peg trying to fit into a round hole. And when I went to school with my peers, I always was one of those kids that had my face in the soup. I was never able to talk about my environment or where I came from because there wasn't that kind of stuff going on around my house. We weren't a close-knit family. We didn't hold each other and say, you know, get into that stuff. So I guess maybe that's why I felt like a victim, you know, all my life. And I craved those things when I was a kid, you know. I always felt different. I wanted those things, and they weren't there. So that was my first reason to blame somebody, you know. I hung around with a crowd of kids in the alleys where I came from. And around 7 and 8 years old, I was already smoking and putting on tattoos. And I was stealing. And for 2.5 years, me and 15 other guys stole anything that wasn't nailed down. And by the time I was 9 years old, I was the youngest kid in Cumberland County to be sentenced to 2 years in a reformatory. And I'll tell you, I was a scared little kid. You know, all I wanted to do was be part of the crowd. I didn't make any conscientious decisions. That's where I wanted to go. But that's where I ended up at 9 years old. And I was taken away at 9 years old, 350 miles from my hometown and locked away for a couple of years. And I'll tell you, I was scared. I was scared. There was a lot of older kids in there. There was a lot of crazy things going on in there, and I didn't like it. I'd like to tell you that straightened me out and made me fly right. Obviously, that's not true. I spent about 6 or 8 months there and got brought back home, and I flew straight for a little while. I haven't even had a drink of alcohol yet, and look where I've been, you know. So I can't tell you that alcoholism or drinking alcohol made a liar or a thief out of me. I was already those things before I picked up a drink of alcohol. I was also one of those kids that always promised myself I would never become what I thought my father was or my mother was. You know, those people that I blamed. I hated God. I turned my back on God at an early age because I thought if God loved me, he wouldn't give me these parents. He wouldn't have put me in this alley, you know. And I'll tell you, I was ready to burn by the time I was 7 or 8 years old because I just couldn't stop doing the things that I liked doing. It seemed like all the fun stuff was a mortal sin, you know. And all the other stuff was you had to walk around with your hands folded. You couldn't do nothing, you know. And I didn't like that. I always liked the excitement, you know. I never had my first drink of alcohol until I was around 13 or 14 years old. I don't remember the exact date. I don't, you know, that stuff today when I think back on is not that important to me. I know that what I did drink was Loganberry wine, and I had 2 quarts of it, and I started drinking with my friends the same way as I saw the people who drank around me. And I thought I was going to drink like a man, and I chug-a-lugged the first quart of wine, and I didn't stop until it was all the way down, and I tried the second one, and I got that one halfway down, and the first one came up, and the rest of the second one, too. So my first drunk is exactly like my last drunk 23 years later. It was a blackout, and I got sick, and every drunk in between was the same way. I can never remember just going out and having one drink, having a drink. What a weird concept that is. I don't understand that at all. You know, somebody go, you want to have a drink? And I said, a drink? You know, it don't make no sense to me, you know. I had friends when they drank, they'd have 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 drinks, and they go, that's enough, and they start getting out of control. It used to baffle the heck out of me, you know. Because when I eat 4 or 5 drinks into me, I'm just starting to gain control, you know. I'm ready to do some serious partying now, you know. Alcohol didn't take a lot from me in the early years, you know. I mean, I didn't have a wife to lose. I didn't have any family to lose. I didn't have a job. I didn't have cars. I didn't have money. I didn't have, well, I had nothing to lose. So alcohol wasn't really a big deal to me when I first started drinking. And I'm a firm believer today, you know, after being in this fellowship for a while, that I don't really think what I drank is really important as what it did for me when I did drink it, you know. I've heard a lot of stories since I've been in AA, and some people talk about getting longer feet and being a better dancer, and I suppose that, you know, it did those things for me too, but I think what it did more than those things for me is it gave me a sense of well-being when I drank. It made me feel like I was as good as everybody else around me. I didn't feel like a poor boy inside, and I didn't feel different then. But, you know, I don't remember when I first started drinking if those were my reasons. I know today that it's a progressive disease. I know I didn't drink every day when I first started drinking. You know, I don't know if we're born with the disease of alcoholism or if it's inherited or whatever. I think I'm an alcoholic today because I drank too much alcohol. That's really what I believe about alcoholism today. And it's a hell of a disease to have. I mean, it's a killer disease. It's killing a lot of people out there. I only had one dream as a child. I came from a musical family. I played guitar and I sang, and I came from a country and western family, and that should just about tell you all there is right there, you know. I heard if you play that stuff backwards today, you get your wife back, you get your kids back, you get your job back. Didn't happen for me. I couldn't wait to get out of Nova Scotia. The only dream I ever had was that I wanted to get out of Nova Scotia, and I wanted to somehow end up in Nashville, Tennessee. That's where I wanted to go. I always wanted to go to Nashville, and I wanted to be a guitar player and a singer, and I wanted to make a whole bunch of money and some records, and I wanted the whole world to look at me and just love me, you know? I mean, that's the only dream I had as a kid. I didn't do anything in school when I lived in the East Coast. I think they kicked me out of grade 3 for not shaving. I'm not sure, you know? I never had any problems in school until I hit grade 1. You know, I said, after that, it just went downhill, you know. And I was so angry, you know, because we were taught by the nuns, and I looked at them like they were the ninja nuns, you know, because they had those long sticks with them, rubber pointers on the end of them, and I was always getting whacked with those things for doing something wrong. So I didn't feel very good about living where I lived, and I thought I'll come up to Ontario. I had a sister that lived in Ontario, and that would be my starting point. And my father was more than glad to get rid of me by the time I left there. I wouldn't do very much around the house. And he gave me a one-way ticket to Ontario, which is about 1,300 miles from Nova Scotia. And I was 15 years old at the time. And I hit my sister's place, and she put up with me for about 2.5 weeks. And I was already so out of control at 15, she wouldn't let me stay in her home anymore. And she booted me out, and I didn't have any place to go. And I didn't know where to go, and I ended up leaving that place with one garbage bag full of clothes. And I hit the streets of London, Ontario, and I ended up in a park called Victoria Park, and I spent the next 6.5 years of my life sleeping on the streets of London, Ontario, in the park. I slept under trees and underground garages and rescue missions and any place I could put my head down. And I joined up with a group of people that they called in that days the hippies, and they had the big floppy bell bottoms on there and tie-dyed shirts, and it was free love and free everything, and you weren't allowed to have a job, and boy, I sure like that one, I'll tell you. I fit right into that, I'll tell you. Thought I'd died and gone to heaven then. And everybody just seemed to accept you for who and what you were. You know, I grew my hair down to my shoulders, and I put on them big bell bottoms, and I sat under trees playing guitars, and I put a picket sign over my shoulder. It was some kind of protest sign. I carried it for a year and a half, and I still can't tell you what it said. I have absolutely no idea. We were always protesting something. I had no idea. I just followed everybody else around having a good time, you know, and we really were street bums. We panhandled, and we stole, and we did anything we could to get our fix. I'm not proud of this stuff. I really ain't. I'm about 5 or 6 or 7 years into my drinking career. I'm 19 years old, and I've been on the streets for 4.5 years at this point. And I only share this to tell you where alcohol can take you. At 19 years old, I found myself sitting under trees with about 300 hippies and thinking that I was just living life wonderful. And a bunch of us would go down to hospitals, and we would steal needles. And we'd panhandle enough money to buy a couple of quarts of Bright 74 wine. And we'd sit in our circles under those trees, and we would crank into our veins 12 and 14 cc's of wine because there wasn't enough for everybody to get a drink out of the bottle. And I watched a lot of my friends die, and I'm not proud of that. And I'll tell you, there's no reason I should be here this morning. I should have died out there because there wasn't anything that I was scared of when I lived out in the streets, you know. I hung around with a ruthless crowd, you know. I didn't have a whole lot of guilt in those days because I didn't have a whole lot of conscience. I had no feelings, you know. I still wasn't losing anything because I still didn't have anything to lose. Now, alcohol is a cunning, baffling, powerful disease, and I'll tell you, sooner or later, it's going to catch up with you. It started catching up with me when I was about 24 years old, and I joined anything and everything that came through the park in those days. And keep an open mind. Like I said, this is just my story. A bunch of Jesus freaks, or so-called Jesus freaks, came through the park in those days, and they had Bibles and big Jesus buttons on their coats, and they had some guitars, and they started singing about how Jesus would free you and, you know, take care of you. I never heard about a God of love that until that point in my life. I never thought about God loving me as an individual or helping me or doing anything for me. God was always a big fire-breathing dragon to me. And these people came in and shared that with me, and I thought, gee, that sounds good. So I went and got me a Bible and a big button, and I took my guitar, and I got into a gospel band, and that was the first time I played with a band, and I was with that group for about 4 years. And we went around from the basement of this church and singing in prisons and telling people to turn their life over to Jesus and sharing the word of the Lord with them. And after we finished, we'd go out in the car and start drinking a few bottles of beer and thinking what a wonderful job we're doing for the Lord, you know, and we'd be rewarding ourselves, you know. And it was crazy. I still didn't know anything, you know. I always looked at other people when I seen that little ray of hope in their eyes, and I thought, well, God can love them because, you know, they can stop doing them things. But I knew God couldn't love me because I couldn't stop doing the things that I was doing. I was a chameleon alcoholic, too. I was the type of person that had such a hate for myself that I would change my colors and my spots to fit my surroundings. I don't know if anybody in here can identify with that. But if I was with my black friends, I tried to be a black man. And if I was with my French friends, I was trying to parley-voo it up, and I didn't know a darn word of French, you know? If I was with an Irishman, God, I used to sit in a bar time after time, and if I sat with a doctor, I could tell this guy how to run his business, you know? And then I'd go over to another table, and then I was a lawyer, you know, and the table before was laughing at me, you know? Crazy, just the craziest stuff, you know? I met a woman at that time in the church that I was affiliated with, and she was a great lady. She really was. She was just one of those ladies that was out of college. She didn't want a whole lot out of life. She wanted to be married to a man who would give her a couple of children, a home, and have some semblance of order in her life. And at 24, 25 years old, I was still playing a real con, and I really conned this lady. I'll tell you, I lied to her from the get-go. And it wasn't until I got married that guilt and shame and remorse really started to play a part in my life. That's when it really started to affect me. And that's where my drinking, I think, really took off, because it seemed like at that point in my life, alcohol was the only thing that would be able to keep that football down in my stomach that was starting to rise up inside of me. I couldn't deal with it sober, you know. And we got married, and we had a couple of wonderful daughters. And I had a chance at life. I remember making that woman all those promises, telling her the things that I was going to do for her. I always had the greatest of intentions, eh? I always did. I would dream my dreams from the bottom of a bottle and never get any closer than that to them, you know. And that used to baffle me right to death, you know, because I had a desire. I wanted to do some good things, you know. But it just seemed as soon as I took a drink, the drink would take me. I had no choice after I picked up the first drink of alcohol. I left the gospel band, and I formed my own country band in London at that time, and I spent the next 7 years playing on the road. And I was playing in bars 4 and 5 nights a week. I was on the road, and I don't really think that it's necessary to share all the details with you here this morning of what kind of a person I was while I was on the road. I know there was never a time I could get up on stage and start performing unless I had a couple of drinks of alcohol. I'd like to be able to tell you that I was a true, honest man and a good husband, and I wasn't anywhere close to those things. I had more phone numbers than I had hair on my head, and I was lying on top of lies. I was a compound liar, and you got to be a good liar when you're a full-blown alcoholic, I'll tell you. You got to be able to cover this one with that one, and I'm telling you, it's just a horrible, horrible way to live. I don't think God ever intended for me to live the way that I had to end up living. I never remember waking up and making a conscientious decision to go and do the things that I'd done, but I was doing them anyway, you know? And I was blaming people, places, and things. I was going crazy with that stuff inside. I was with that lady for about 10 years, and in the middle of those 10 years, my brothers tried to help me. We were living in Alberta. I was going through a geographical cure. I was one of those kind of people thought, if I could just get to this town, I'll be okay. If I have a new start, I'll be all right. And I'd get to that town, and I'd last for a couple of weeks, and then I'd run into those kind of people that we run into, those kind of people that I like to hang around. And, you know, my brother would invite me up. It was Christmas time. I remember one particular time. It was Christmas, and my brother invited me up to give me about 2.5-3 weeks' work so I'd have some money for Christmas to buy my children some presents and to pay some of the bills. And I thought it was a great idea, and I went up there, and I started cleaning these nightclubs for them. Whoa, what a place for an alcoholic to clean. And I had to work from 12 o'clock at night until 6 o'clock in the morning. And the first night I'm in there, I'm with a big Yugoslavian guy that doesn't know any more than 2 words of English. And I don't know how to talk to him, and he doesn't know how to talk to me. And I haven't had a drink for a couple of days, and I'm shaking. And we're in there to clean this place, and then I look over, and I see this bar, and it's got this big steel cage across it. And all these bottles with them little shot spouts in them. And I just looked at them, and my mouth started to water. And he looked at me, and I he was an alcoholic too, obviously. He seen my eyes, what, you know. And he took me over to the bar, and he showed me how to take 2 straws and tape them together and put your hands in between those bars and wiggle those bottles around and slide them straws down the end of them shot spouts. A straw will fit in there as snug as your hand in a glove. And we had straws stuck in every bottle behind that bar. And we'd start sucking on these straws and then running over and putting a mouthful of Coke in. And by the time 6 o'clock came in the morning, we were both passed out on the floor. And that went on for 2 weeks. I was drunk for 2 solid weeks. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven, man. I'll tell you. And by the time I left there, I owed my brother $412, and I smashed his car up. So much for good intentions. Boy, I'll tell you, that used to baffle me. That used to drive me crazy, eh? And I come home feeling that stuff inside again. How am I going to say it to her this time? What am I going to tell her? What am I going to come up with this time? And I'd come home and I'd see my children, my daughters, and I'm telling you, it still breaks my heart today. To look in the eyes of a 6-year-old child looking up at you going, Daddy, why? And you don't know how to answer her. I've come up with a lot of lies and a lot of cons, but I could never look into my daughter's eyes, eh? And it used to drive me crazy. It used to drive me crazy. I used to be so mad at God in the morning when I was hungover. I'd shuffle the kids off to school and get a couple of beers into me, and I thought, I'm going to be okay after I got those drinks into me. I'd just start feeling better again, you know. And then I'd get mad. I'd put on George Jones, any weeping song I could find, you know. And I'd sit there and I'd start getting the poor me's and the if onlys, you know, that kind of stuff. And I'd stand on the floor and I'd start getting in fights with God. I'd say, it's so crazy, eh? I'd just have a pair of shorts on and a bottle of beer, and I'd be cursing at him. Just cursing at him, and I'd be saying, if you're there, I just want him to come out of the clouds. I say, come on, it's just me and you. Let's get it on. Come on. And I'd start calling him names, hoping he'd show up. You know, what a foolish person I was. My sponsor used to say, you're so lucky a big hand didn't come out of the clouds and go, shut up. You know? Life expectancy of a fool. But I do that, you know. I was hurting so bad, I just wanted to die. And I was such a, you know, I can remember how suicidal I was in those days. Waking up was really bad for me in the morning. So I used to wake up and think, oh, God, another morning. You know, I used to just wish I'd die. I used to contemplate suicide. I think I got to a point in my life, you know, it was about a year before the end of my marriage. And I talk about my first marriage because it was so important to me. These were the end days for me as a drinker. And in that last year, I was invited out to places like charity functions, and there was just old people in wheelchairs, just crippled people in wheelchairs and crutches, and I was asked to show up as a guest to sing and play a few old songs for these people. And that used to pressure me up so bad, I would just have to get drunk before I'd even get up on stage. And, you know, the more alcohol I drank, the scarier I got, and I couldn't ever figure that out, yay? And it was no big deal. There was only like 40 or 50 old people. Half of them couldn't hear you, and the other half couldn't see you, you know? It's crazy, eh? But I still have to be drunk before I got up on stage. And one of the things I did during the course of one of these things, and this just drive me crazy, this stuff. I just put back about 5 or 6 doubles before I got up on stage, and I went into a blackout on stage. And, oh, it was about 23 below zero in Alberta. My wife was with me. I had a couple of my friends with me. I was not known particularly as a violent person. I never got into very many fights. I showed up at a lot of beatings, but I never got into very many fights, you know. So, could block a good left with my chin. And we got to this function, and I went into this blackout, and the next thing I realize, I'm up against the wall. I'm surrounded by 8 people. They're trying to hold me back, and I busted a table in two, and I punched one of my friend's glasses into the side of his eye. And I smashed a big hole in the wall, and these old people were just trying to get out of the room. You know, there was people pushing them out the doors. And I had no shirt on. I just had my pants on. I have no idea how I got there, you know? I went back into this blackout. And the second time I come out of it, I was standing outside, and I was trying to pick up the front end of a cop car with the cop still inside of it, telling him to get out of the car and bring his dog with him, you know? My wife was standing there just looking at me. Ain't having no part of this, you know. Never been into a blackout 3 times, but this time I would. And I went back into the blackout. When I came out, I was hanging off the side of a 4-story building that I lived in. 4 stories off the ground, 23 below zero, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm not sure what time it was. Have no idea how I got there. No idea at all. Shuffled over to the balcony. Went through a window, down the hallway, kicked the guy's door open. All kinds of crazy stuff. That was the last year of my drinking, eh? It was so bad. I'm telling you, I was hurting so bad inside. I was now bleeding out of just about every orifice of my body. I was 194 pounds. I was a superintendent of that 4-story building that I was hanging off of. Nobody would employ me at this point. And I conned this guy into giving me a job and telling him what a great job I'd take care of this building. I filled it up full of alcoholic Newfoundlanders. Made their own beer, you know. So I knew when I got up in the morning, I could get a fix anytime I wanted. I had all the keys to the apartments. So when they went to work, I knew where I was getting my next drink, you know. That's how crazy it could get, you know. I mean, I was dying from the inside out, you know. I spent my whole life trying to find something on the outside to fix me up on the inside. I always looked for it in people, places, things, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know. So I ran the gauntlet, you know. I always believed that I could run my own life, that I was capable of stopping whenever I wanted to stop. I always believed that. I had an ego that wouldn't quit, you know, and had the brain of a pea. Just couldn't keep up. Couldn't keep up. And the end of my drinking came on August the 15th, 1983, when my wife finally had enough, and she took the only 2 things that I had left in life that I loved. And I mean the only 2 things. She took my daughters and she left. And she said, we're going to have a divorce. Now, my wife came from a family with 16 brothers and sisters. And she had 10 brothers that were all 240 and up. And every one of them knew karate. They all came from Chicago. Get the message? I got it. They all called me up. And every one of them said, if you show up at the house... I really wasn't that brave. I really wasn't, you know. I was scared, I'll tell you. I didn't show up at the house. 3 or 4 days later, I was walking down the road, and I fell over in a ditch. I just fell over. I suffered a severe mental and nervous breakdown, and I've been to hospitals and psych wards 3 or 4 times through my drinking career. I hit the ditch in 1983, broken. And I laid in that ditch for a period of time, I don't know how long. And the one thing I do remember from that ditch in Alberta in 1983 was that out of nothing but sheer agony and pain and despair, I bowed my head And I said, God, if you show me how to get sober, I won't drink no more. And I don't know what you people call a miracle. I don't know if it's small enough to put in a bread box or big enough to fill this room. I don't know if it has eyes or arms or clothes. All I know is what I feel inside. And since that day, I've not found it necessary to pick up a drink of alcohol. I was picked up out of that ditch by a 17-year-old boy that I was giving guitar lessons to. I was taken down to the 8th floor of the Medicine Hat Hospital in Alberta. And I was to go into a psychiatric ward for the last time in my life, and I was strapped on that bed for 3 weeks. And the doctors came in and started offering me handfuls of happy candy, and I wouldn't have any part of that. I don't know what happened to me inside, but I told them, if I'm going to die, let me die. But I'm not going to take any more candy, and I'm not going to drink no more. If I'm going to die, just let me die. And I'll never forget those days, you know. It's awful when you're laying there and you got straps on your arms and legs, and you have a guy with a gun on his side that walks into a toilet with you when you're not even allowed to go to the bathroom by yourself. It's a hell of a place to end up, you know. It's only my story, you know. I don't think that it's necessary to go that way today, but that's where I had to go, you know. And I remember a nurse one time put her arms on my shoulders when I was in this hospital. I was about 4 or 5 days in there, and I was hanging onto these drapes, and I was shaking. My skin was crawling, and I was sweating, and I was, man, it was just crazy. I was just having a terrible time with this thing. And she would put her arms on my shoulders, and she just rubbed my shoulders for a couple of minutes. And she kept saying, Rick, hang in there for a minute. Just hang in for another minute. You'll be okay. You'll get through. And that's all I remember hearing in there, you know, and I just kept hanging in and hanging in. And they say it's got to get bad before it gets good. I guess it's true. And I guess about a week later, they were sending in these head shrinks and these psychologists, and they were trying to figure out what made me tick, and I wasn't talking, and just awful experience, I'll tell you. Awful expensive club we belong to, friends. Eh? Most expensive club in the world, as far as I'm concerned, you know. Somebody asked me a while back, how do you get to AA? I told him, go to hell and make a U-turn. I should just about put you at your first meeting, as far as I'm concerned, because that's how I got here, you know. Eh? I can't believe how differently I feel today. You know, they say if you walk like a duck and you quack like a duck, chances are you're a duck. And I know a duck walked past my room that day. It was a one-legged duck. It was a lady who was sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous about 12 and a half or 13 years. She had one leg, and she was suffering mental depression because they were taking another part of that stump that she had left. It was gangrenous or something. They were doing more operations on her, and she hobbled past my room one day. She didn't stop in. She didn't say hi. She didn't say anything. But the next day, she came back to my room, and she hobbled up to my bed on her crutches. And this is how it happened for me. And she dropped the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on my bed that day. And she wrote her name and her phone number on the inside, and I remember her name was Bernice, my mother's name. And she walked up to my bed, and she put this book down, and she looked at me, and she said, Rick, if you ever need a friend, give me a call. And that's all she said. She turned around and she left. And I've never put my eyes on that woman since that day. I was 4 years sober, and I remembered this lady. And I had to try to get a hold of her in Alberta. I called all over the country, man, trying to get a hold of this lady to tell her how much I loved her, you know. It's important for me to remember this stuff, eh? It's really important, because I don't want to go back to where I came from, you know. I got a hold of her after being sober for 4 years, because it wasn't until I was sober 4 years in Alcoholics Anonymous I realized what a great miracle that had happened to me in that ditch that day, you know. And I just wanted to thank this lady. I just wanted to tell her that I loved her for carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And I called her up, and it took me about a month to get a hold of her. And I talked to her on the phone for a minute, and she called me collect, and I was in Ontario, and she was in Alberta. And she said, somebody told me to call you. I don't know who you are. And I told her who I was and what had happened, and I asked her if she remembered it. And she couldn't remember for the life of her of that happening at all. And ain't that how it happens in Alcoholics Anonymous? Eh? Ain't that how it happens, eh? We never know who we're going to help. Not our job to know that stuff, just the job to get well and carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, eh? I got taken from that hospital to a recovery center in Alberta called 1835 House Recovery Acres, and there began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was in that place that I spent 6 months, and I was taken through the steps for the first time in my life. I did my first step 4, my first step 5 in this place, and cleared up a lot of those glaring defects. I was going through a divorce. I never did get my wife back. Never did get my kids back, but I got somebody else's. And she was really angry, and she would write letters to me from her lawyers, and I was going crazy in this recovery center, and I didn't think I'd be able to get sober, and my sponsor kept telling me, hang in, Rick, hang in. It'll get better. It'll get better. Like, I hated people when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous because you were smiling. You were happy, and you were clean, and I didn't understand that stuff. I was just dying from the inside out, and that's all. I couldn't imagine being happy. I didn't know if there was life after alcohol. I couldn't imagine that. What will I do now that I don't drink, you know? And today I look at the drink itself. I find that a very, very small part of the problem, you know? It's the living thing inside that I have a hard time dealing with today. You know, it's continuing to apply the principles. It's continuing to turn my life and my will over the care of God as I understand Him, you know? And that's where my journey began, and it was just been one day at a time since. I learned some stuff when I came around Alcoholics Anonymous. The things that were told me was to get active, get a sponsor, join a group, do the steps, get out of yourself, stay out of your own head, eh? Because that's where the enemy lies, eh? I always had the committee meetings going off, and I was never invited. I always ended up just suffering the results. Well, I had all them voices, you know. They used to baffle me. They come out of nowhere, you know. I'd get out of bed in the morning and miss the floor, you know, no problem. And it didn't seem, you know, like every time I get up, I know when I get up, my disease may not get me right now, but it's waiting for me. It'll get me. Sometime through the day, my disease will get me if I'm not careful, you know. I had to do things like learn to get comfortable, not only in my own skin, but I had to get comfortable with God as I understand Him, and I didn't understand God, and I still don't understand God, and I will never understand God because I am not God. There are two things I found out since I've been in AA, too, that there is, one, that there is a God, and two, I'm not Him, you know. And that was a big revelation to me, you know. I found out that I have my place in the universe, only it's not the center. Didn't like that one very much either, you know. I used to hate time. Time used to drive me crazy. Give it time, Rick. Give it time. I thought if one more person comes up and tells me time, I'm going to choke his head off, eh? Time was my archenemy when I got here, you know? It used to drive me crazy. And fear. One friend of mine told me fear is a frantic effort to appear recovered. I thought, some truth to that for me, you know? There's some truth to that. It took a long time for me to find out who Rick Robichaud was. I knew who the characters were, you know? I knew who this guy was and that guy was. I was scared to death to find out who I was. I didn't know if I'd like myself. I didn't believe I would like myself. And the evidence was there, because if you don't like yourself, you're always trying to be somebody else. There's evidence that you don't like yourself, you know? And I knew that that was true for me, you know? I knew that anybody who found out that stuff about me wouldn't be around me for very long, because I always had the answers for everybody else's life and no answers for mine, you know? This stuff drove me crazy, and I was so scared when I first started this thing, you know? I think that if Alcoholics Anonymous was only a place to get sober, I wouldn't have stayed. I really don't, because I had a much bigger problem on the inside than alcohol. I had a real bad living problem, you know. My first sponsor told me when I did my step three with him, he told me, we got into a room together, he said, get on your knees. And I went, what? Get on my knees? I don't get on my knees to nobody. Well, except for the porcelain God I used to pray to every morning, you know. And I had to do the things that I had to do to get to where I'm at today, you know. One of the things that I heard in a meeting one time was that if you do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. And if that doesn't spell the word pattern, I don't know what does. Because that's what I suffered from my whole life, doing what I always did and getting what I always got. You know? I used to scream at people and smash on tables in meetings. I don't know why they put up with me. I was so crazy. But they used to just sit there loving me and saying, it'll be okay, Rick. And I used to say things to them like, well, you told me to work through this and the pain will go away. Well, I worked through it and I still got the pain. What's the problem here? And this Al-Anon lady looked at me and said, have you ever considered working through it in another direction? And I thought, I hate you. She's a great lady, man. I really love her. Now, what? Much that I cannot express it in words. I really can't. You know, I can't express for you inside this morning what I feel like today. 12 years, one day at a time, compared to what I felt like when I got here, you know? That is such a difficult process, and yet something inside of me wants to tell you how much I love you and how much you've done for me. Have I found a God that I got comfortable with and I know He loves me today? I was going to kill my father when I was 14 years old. I held him by the throat.
And I told him I would kill him if he ever put his hands on me again. And at 8 years sober, I held him in my arms for the last time. So 4 years ago now. He was 87 pounds. And I told him how much I loved him. You know? Where are you going to get that? You ain't got enough money in this room to buy it, as far as I know. Really don't, you know? And I got to make an amends with my wife and with my children. You know? I got to have two gifts back that I gave away when I was out there practicing. My self-respect and my dignity. I didn't care about nobody or nothing, and I cared even less about myself. And I've acquired those things since I've come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been given so many things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they all add up to the same thing, gratitude. Gratitude, you know? I was never able to love myself, and people said really stupid things to me in here. They said, we'll love you till you can love yourself. Right? Where else are you going to get that but Alcoholics Anonymous, eh? I've been praying for 12 years, and I had a gift this weekend to go to Dr. Bob's house, you know? Coming down here this morning will go down in my heart for the rest of my life. I'll remember this till the day I die, of having the privilege, for the first time in my sobriety. I didn't come down here to speak to you people this morning. I came down to say thank you. Thank you for my sobriety. I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to do that because when I see the miracle that happened to Dr. Bob and Bill, Bill speaks about it in his story. And he says in his mind's eye how it seemed like a warm wind blew through the room. It happened in the United States of America. And I'm very proud of you people. You are so gifted and so blessed. You have no idea that people in other countries that were dying from the inside out, that had no idea how to live, and had to do nothing more than hurt a lot of people through their whole lives. Because of what God has done for you people, it has stretched across into other countries and touched people like me. That is power. That is real power. And it can't be anything but God's power when I look at it. Nothing could cause that kind of an effect as far as I know. I've seen nothing that comes even close to the fellowship and the spirituality of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart, I really do. It's a great honor for me to be able to stand here and tell you that this morning. You know? And if you can't feel good about nothing else today, you can look up here and look at this person and feel good about me. Because you give it to me. You give me one day at a time. I found happiness in a relationship today, something I could never function in before. I have a wonderful wife, and we have a wonderful life together. We kid each other all the time. We go around to a lot of meetings. We get to stay active, and I sponsor people. We pray, and we do all the things that we've done and that we've been taught to do right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is a tremendous, tremendous gift. It really is. And I think that that keeps me feeling just a little bit responsible inside. Because if our traditions say that we are based on attraction rather than promotion, what's going to keep the next alcoholic that walks through that door in this room today? Is there going to be something attractive enough in here for him to want to come back to another meeting? Well, if there's not, then I think there's something wrong in my life. There was nothing attractive about me until I got to AA. Nothing. I used to have hair down to here. I used to wear a big old floppy cowboy hat. I used to wear sandals. I looked like a total fool. I looked like an idiot. And I went to meetings like that for the first 2 years. When I got my first year medallion from my sponsor, I stood up in the front of a room with my chest stuck out like a peacock, and I was waiting for this man to worship me in front of all the people that I knew. And I thought, God, I have arrived. And he stood up, and he gave me my first year medallion, and he told everybody, Rick taught me 7 new ways to feel sorry for myself this year. That's a wonderful human being that can do that to you. I want you to know. I hated that man from the bottom of my soul. But he knew me. He wasn't a stupid man. He was already sober 7 years. And he was my first sponsor. And they gave him 6 weeks to live when they brought him through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a very sick, dying man. And he's celebrating 19 years this year, grace of God, one day at a time. And I call him every year that I acquire another year of sobriety, I call him up. And him and I just laugh and love each other on the phone. And I'll tell you, I know God's going to bring us back together someday. That man saved my life. He really did. He saved my life. I don't think there's a whole lot more. I just want to thank you so much for loving me and for having me down here. Dawn, for loving me and for carrying me around. I tell you, we really do walk around on the shoulders of giants, don't we? And Don's one of those giants in my life today, and I hope he's one in your life. And I hope when Don's gone, that there's other people in this room that's going to pick up and carry on from where Don and other giants in this room have left off. You know, because there's too many people dying out there from the disease of alcoholism. So thank you very much. God bless you real, real good. And I hope you have another day of sobriety.
Rick, I certainly want to thank you. You know, you said a lot of things today that, and you talked about the shackles, and I was there. You know, there's nothing more humiliating. And there was a guy from Kent, Ohio, a professor in the paradox in the second book, and I used to see him when I went to school in Akron, and he said you had to surrender to win, and you had to die to be born again, and you had to be sick to get well, and you got to give it away to keep it, and that's just what you've done this week, you know. And you talked about how we're going to get better. We've got to stop doing the things we like. That's the sixth step. And seventh step is start doing the things we don't like to do. There's a lot of things we don't like to do, but we got to do it or it won't work. And you know, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you had nothing to lose. Most of us come here with nothing to lose. Maybe a job, a driver's license, a wife. And those are just things that you can lose once in a while. But you know, when you get here, the longer you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, the price gets higher. And if you don't give anything back to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a guy, Eddie Gordon, used to say, you're like a swamp. You take everything in and you give nothing back. And if you give something back, the stream keeps on flowing, you know. And that's where it's at. And then I say this, sometimes it may confuse you, but you've been here long enough, you should understand that if alcohol is my problem, I'm not an alcoholic. You said that so well today. We don't ever inventory alcohol. We inventory our character defects. We inventory the fact that we lie. We don't believe that first step. And these are the things that alcohol never did that for. We inventory those. We don't inventory alcohol. And if I'm an alcoholic, then alcohol is not my problem. Because if it works that way, treatment centers would have 100% recovery because everybody comes out of there without any alcohol in their system. So they don't have that great recovery. The recovery rate comes from Cleveland, Ohio, Akron, Ohio, Canada, wherever we are, when they completely surrender. And I'm certain that if everyone in this room, who have been out there once or twice before, thinks if we put you up against a coal stove and burned your ass once or twice, I'll bet you would never do it again. Or if I handed you a glass and said, this is strychnine, would you drink it? And you'd swear back, hell no, what's the matter, you're crazy? But every time if I said, have a drink, hell yeah, I'll drink that, what do we care? So we'll pick you up one more time. One more time. And how many times do you have to be picked up? Rick, your last time to be picked up was you laid in the gutter and God entered into your life because you surrendered. You must surrender to win. You got to be ripe, ready, and rotten. I think in 74 when they said we're going to raise the bottom, We did nothing but bring in more people that want to be here. Until you want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you want to get sober, this thing will never work. You can sit in a chicken coop for 6 weeks, 6 months, or a year, and you'll never lay an egg. And if you sit in AA for all these meetings and do nothing and give nothing back, you're a taker, and takers are losers. Flat-out losers. Alcoholics Anonymous works because it's one drunk talking to another. And that's the only way that's going to work, you know. I just want to thank you for being a friend. Thank you for when I get to Canada, you take us around. But, you know, I certainly want to thank you and your wife for being here. So let's give them another hand. And I want to say this before I get off. On November the 12th, in Akron, Ohio, is Gratitude Sunday. Now, we've been there for 11 years. We've been doing it in Akron. And this is the first time where the second generation of Alcoholics Anonymous members are going to start to move in and relinquish some of the old-timers who've passed away. And last year we had a total of 12 people there with 546 years of sobriety, and we lost three of those people in the last year. So what we're going to do is we're starting to bring people in from Pennsylvania, from Canada, from Cleveland here, who have moved into the 35-year and up bracket, so that leaves me out of that one. But, you know, it's going to be, and I invite you all to Akron, Ohio, at Dr. Bob's house. And if you can't get into the big house, we've got the house next door, and it'll be wired into the house next door. And if you haven't been to Dr. Bob's, I say this. You know, it's a labor of love, and there's five or six people in this room that break their neck for that house. And we don't even get gas money for it. But what the rewards are is when someone walks into that house, as Rick said, when you see people who came there, like Mike was there the other day, and the guy had 2 weeks to live, and he begged his mother to drive him down from Canada. And he was dying of cancer, and he was wrapped up in ACE bandages to keep the swelling down. And he was sober 12 years, and he told his mother, "Mom, we'll get the car warmed up, we're going to Cleveland." And she said, "We'll never make it, son. We'll never make it, you're too sick." He says, "We'll stop and rest." And they stopped all along the way and let the boy lay on the ground or lay in the back seat until he got enough strength to continue on to Cleveland, Ohio, Akron, Ohio. Are we grateful enough for what we've got? Are we willing to give back anything? Are we willing to be just say, "Here, help me help somebody today. Let me help somebody new who's never been to AA." How about becoming a power of example, like Rick said? Powers of example are what attract people into this fellowship. He never saw that woman before. You'll never know when you meet that new person, you just offer the hand. It may help you. My sponsor came to me. I didn't go to him. He came to me and told me I had a problem. And because of the way he looked that morning and how much I hated him for the things he did, I liked him because he looked good and his eyes were sparkling. Real members of Alcoholics Anonymous are never really unhappy. Their eyes are always smiling. Their eyes are always happy. And I want every one of you to come to Akron. Believe me, there's room for 200 people. We're fishing two houses. But come. Come to Akron, Ohio. And November the 12th, it is, I think, 1965. And meet the new generation of AAs. We're going to have to take over now. Because we're getting over. Okay, I want to turn this over to our secretary now. Thank you again, Rick.